सतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो
greetings, namaste, welcome, good evening, good morning, good afternoon. It's really so great to be with all of you again and to take the next steps on our journey through the Yoga Sutra. And as we start, I just wanted to say that I spent some time this week trying to decide whether to continue going deep into the practice paradigms that Patanjali gives us in book one, or to pivot and complete the discussion on obstacles that starts in book two by introducing the kleshas, the underlying afflictions, the word klesha means affliction, that are the ultimate source of our samskaras, our vasanas, and our experiences of karma. And I'm drawn to doing this partly because of the moment we're in and the experiences that some of us are having as we navigate this moment, and partly because it clarifies so crucially our motivations for practicing yoga. And then we'll come back to the teachings about the doorways to samadhi, some of them later in this class and some of them in our next class. And I also wanted to give you two pieces of news. One, we're having a Q&A this Sunday at noon Pacific time, which Deb will send you a note about. And two, we are going to be having a second series on the Yoga Sutra, since obviously we've just scratched the surface of this incredibly rich text. And that will start in mid-June, June 17th to be exact. You'll be getting a note about that. In the second class, we'll dive deeply into book two, which contains not only the famous teachings on the eight limbs of yoga, but also the basic teachings on karma, on how samskaras are formed, on the direct practices for transforming samskaras in the moment. You know, as this book is called Samadhipada and deals with really the highest level of experience and practice, in book two is called Sadhana Pada, meaning the book on practice. And that's the book which assumes that people practicing yoga are not necessarily super advanced, and which really shows us how to start from where we are. And where we are is, to one degree or another, subject to the action of the kleshas. And then we'll go more deeply into the nitty-gritty of yoga transformation by delving into book three, which is not taught as much as book two, and that's the chapter on how we can use meditation practice to really discover the essence of pretty much anything in both the physical and the subtle realms. So let's find ourselves a comfortable posture. Remember to use the breath to let you ground through the sits bones and really find a firm way of being in your seat. And then with the inhalation, feel yourself becoming heavy through the base, the buttocks and thighs. And with the exhalation, let the torso rise up through the crown. I've been working with an amazing body worker who is constantly telling me, stretch your head up, you know, stretch your posture, look upward so that you can kindle the sense of wonder. And I've actually been doing it and realizing that he's absolutely right, that we can always get taller. So get taller. Feel yourself growing. Feel your shoulder blades releasing onto the back. Feel your chest lifting and opening. And just for a moment, follow the breath. Some of you have been sitting for a little while. Some of you just came onto the call after what may have been a busy day. And so we just take these moments to let the breath ground us. And now to begin to recognize that we are seated together around the magical lake, Lake Manasarovar, the great lake of consciousness, with its deep blue waters, in its exquisite sacred spot surrounded by snowy peaks. Seated around the lake with us are all the beings in this community, all of us from different continents, from different time zones, from different houses, all of us of different ages. And with us, for those of you who would like to invite them, are the people that we feel close to, the people that we would like to have experienced the blessing of this exquisite lake, of each other's presence, and of the teaching. So as you feel yourself sitting with the lake, sitting at the lake, you can bring your attention into the heart, maybe putting your hands over the heart, your right palm over the sternum and your left palm on top of it. And sense the way in which your hands, the energy in your hands and the energy behind your breastbone can actually support each other, so that the hands cradle the heart and the heart opens with this feeling of being protected. Now find yourself holding the candle and using your magical power of illuminating anything with the fingertips of your dominant hand. Emit the flame from your forefinger, light the candle, and then holding it in your cupped hands, create an intention for yourself for this evening of practice. And my intention, may our practice uplift us. May it carry us further in our journey of enlightenment. May it give us wisdom, comfort, and peace in this difficult time. May it enable us to be of help to others. And may all beings benefit from what we are doing together here. And now we'll chant the opening mantras. Three recitations of Om, our invocation of the inner teacher, Ishwara, whom we meditate on under the name of Shiva, the great lake of consciousness, the great light of consciousness. And our invocation to the primordial goddess. And then we'll chant the traditional mantras, invoking the presence of the sage Patanjali. Om. 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 And one more time, allowing the Om sound at the end of Om to reverberate in the soft palate. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchit Ananda Murtaye Nisprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Triambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhava Bodhe Nishreyase jangalikayamane samsara hala hala moha shantyai abhahu purushakaram shankha chakra tat siddharinam sahasra shirasam shvetam pranamami patanjalim pranamami patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim. And firming your posture if need be, always a good idea. Letting yourself grow from the base up through the crown. Allow your attention to flow into the heart. And begin to let the breath flowing with hum on the inhalation, sa on the exhalation, allow the flow of the breath to begin to open your connection to the energy of your own heart, to the lotus of the heart, the subtle space within the center of the body. As you inhale, sense the touch of the breath spreading through the chest area. tune into the feeling of expanding prana that arises at the top of the inhalation and expands during the exhalation. And as you allow the breath very gently, very softly, to flow in and open up your sense of the heart region, imagine it as filled with subtle luminosity. Sense the presence of a subtle flame there, like the flame of a candle. Because that flame, which is known as the light of the self, the thumb-sized person inside the heart, because that flame exists, we don't really have to imagine it, simply to take for granted, assume its presence, and allow the mantra hum to flow into the flame, flow into the luminosity of the heart as an offering, and then allow the exhalation to flow through the whole chest area with the sound sa. For some of you, that visual feeling of illumination in the heart may be natural. For others, it may be more of a sensation, a feeling of subtle tickling, perhaps, or a sense of relaxation in the heart. And as the mantra deepens your sense of presence in the heart region, see if you can become present to the feeling of pleasure, of contentment, even of joy within the heart center. And just let the breath and the mantra nestle your attention deeper and deeper into the heart. In last week's class, we started discussing practices, including this one, that create the space in the mind that we can use as a basis for effective meditation. And one of the insights that I get from reading this chapter in the Yoga Sutra is that many of the meditation practices that we do are actually meant to, so to speak, cultivate the space in the mind, in the citta, that allows meditation to take place. Because the really deep truth that the Yoga Sutra, in its subtler, in its subtler sutras, points to is that meditation is actually a natural state, and we'll see that when we look at Book Two in a more specific way. In other words, the initial practice is for focusing the mind, is for bringing the mind together, for, in the famous metaphor, bringing the scattered metal filings of our vritti-laden mental state into some form of congruence by putting them in touch with the magnet of our central practice, which in this case is the heart. But behind the whole process is the understanding that the human mind, your individual mind, my individual mind, are actually limited, sort of personally formed aspects of the universal mind, pure awareness, the great mind, as they sometimes say in Zen. And in the theistic tantric traditions like Kashmir Shaivism or Sri Vidya Tantra, that universal mind is often called God's mind, Shiva's mind, Chitti Shakti, the mind of the Great Mother. Now, the yoga tradition classically is non-theistic, like Buddhism. But as we've been seeing, the yoga tradition also contains the concept, the recognition of Ishwara. Ishwara literally means Lord. And Ishwara, as we've seen, is described as a special Purusha. Purusha means person or being. A being who never got bound by limitation and who lives within consciousness as the formless guiding teacher, the inner guru within each of us. The verse that we sing, the Om Namah Shivaya Gurave verse, actually points to the same truth. You know, it addresses Shiva as the inner guru whose nature is pure being, pure awareness and extraordinary bliss, and who, among other qualities, who is without form, without a body, but who is never not supporting us. So this is a perfect description of Ishwara. Purusha means, you know, is a masculine noun, so Purusha is usually considered masculine, while the universal creative force, Prakriti, is considered feminine. And if we understand that Ishwara is an inner reality, is really the guiding principle living within our heart or living within the field of our awareness, invisibly pointing us towards the path, carrying us through experience after experience over lifetimes until we come to the place where we are able to actually not just recognize the truth, but essentially live in it. Purusha is always accompanied by Prakriti, and Prakriti is who we mostly work with in our daily life, who we are. We are, in fact, made from Prakriti. We live within Prakriti, and most of our meditation takes place within the field of Prakriti. So Prakriti comes from the root that means to create. Pra comes from means create. And Kriti is based on the root that means act. So Prakriti is the one who acts creatively. And, you know, as many of you know, in the West, Prakriti is often translated or identified as Mother Nature because she's the matrix of all that exists in the natural world. And in her unmanifest form, Prakriti is described as a formless mass of unmanifest creativity, pure potentiality, brimming with possibility. And if you've ever gone really deep into the field of your own mind in meditation, you know, just found yourself in this realm that can open up in meditation, You may have experienced this directly. If you know Deepak Chopra's work, you know that he often talks about something he calls the field of all possibility. That's Prakriti, the unmanifest creative mind. And our own limited mind, this is of course a core teaching of the tantras, has that same innate creativity, because our mind is utterly a part of the mind of Prakriti. Now, a little metaphysical piece here. Some yoga lineages talk about two levels of Prakriti, the higher Prakriti and the lower Prakriti. So the higher Prakriti is literally the face of the Absolute. In other words, at that level, Purusha and Prakriti are inseparable. They are two facets, two faces of the same vastness. So in other words, this will be familiar to you students of Tantra, at that level, Prakriti is another name for the primordial Shakti, the creative power of the Absolute. And in a tantric interpretation of the Yoga Sutra's analysis of reality, at the highest level, Purusha and Prakriti are Shiva and Shakti by another name. You know, there is a good reason why Patanjali is often identified with Shiva, and why many yogis are, you know, do their devotional practice in the name of Shiva. So Shiva, Purusha and Prakriti are two faces of the awesome profundity of consciousness itself. One face that is still, unmoving, always the witness. The other face, which is endlessly creative, always changing, never still, always dancing. And what happens is that in the process of creatively manifesting this physical universe, a natural split occurs between Prakriti and Purusha, which creates a fundamental experience of duality. And when we say that the Yoga Sutra is a dualistic text, what I believe we mean, and I have some backing for this, is that the Yoga Sutra deals primarily with the situation we find ourselves in as split off fragments of Purusha Prakriti. So in our state, Purusha, which remember, innately is innately vast, limitless, and you know, aware at a level that is completely beyond our normal mind, Purusha becomes a limited individual consciousness, the antaratma, the inner self within the body. And Purusha in the body is pure awareness, free of any attributes, awareness with no object. And we could say that it's the awareness that surfaces when you ask one of the great inquiry questions like, who am I without words? Who am I really? If you really do that inquiry, there'll be a wordless experience that arises, which is an experience of Purusha that can deepen the more you practice. Prakriti, on the other hand, becomes everything else, including your mind, your ego, the ahamkara, your senses, your inner senses, your outer senses, your physical body, and also the universe we experience as being outside ourselves, which yoga wisdom tells us is actually not outside ourselves. It's really actually being produced from our inner core. So that's the so-called lower Prakriti. And I'm going to say this twice because it's a crucial statement. It is the lower Prakriti that we experience as our personal, mental, emotional, perceptual field, as well as the apparent outside world. So, you know, and this is very important because what the Yoga Sutras aim to do is to get us to distinguish our consciousness, Purusha, from its field of experience, its Prakriti. So it is the lower Prakriti, our personal Prakriti, that we experience as our own mental, emotional, and perceptual field. And I find one of the reasons why I adore this text is not because of its metaphysics. The tantric non-dual metaphysics is much more inclusive. but in its emphasis on how you go about separating the witness self, pure consciousness, from the contents of the mind, so that you can free yourself from your identification with the limitations that you believe are characteristic of you, which in fact they are not. And that, from a tantric point of view, is what it means to separate Purusha from Prakriti. It's not that they ever really become separate. It's that as we practice and purify the experience of our Prakriti and recognize and learn to rest in pure consciousness, that's when the experience of the world that Prakriti has become begins to become a source of ecstasy rather than a source of suffering. So I just want to say a little bit more about personal Prakriti. Obviously, all humans share the same basic structure. We all have inner instruments of perception and sense-making, which are pretty much, you know, have the same qualities in general. We have an intellect, we have an ego, we have this mental tool that takes in information and makes sense of it. We all have physical bodies. We all perceive more or less the same objective universe. But our inner experience of ourselves and the world is absolutely personal. It has things in common, of course, but it's not shared. And the experience we have of ourselves and consequently of everything we see, hear, touch, smell, and taste is going to be dependent on the quality and the state of our personal Prakriti, which, remember, is essentially the conglomeration of our vrittis, our samskaric patterns, and our vasanas, the deep-seated tendencies rising from the karmic backpack that every soul carries. So one of the ways that we can discuss the initial aim of yoga practice, or the stated aim of yoga practice, as stated in Sutras 2 and 3 that we looked at the first week, is to smooth out, even dissolve, the waves, the movements in our personal Prakriti, so that we can experience, first of all, so that we can experience Prakriti as what she is, which is to say a mass of essentially creative ecstasy. You know, our own inner being can be experienced as a mass of creative ecstasy. Some of you guys have that experience. But also, of course, to recognize and learn to rest in, dwell in, pure undifferentiated Purusha, the consciousness which is our deepest individual being, our true self, the Atman. And this means that we need to get what our personal Prakriti actually looks and feels like in its current state, and to understand it in a shall we say, in a mature way. But because at the beginning and way along the path, we're so identified with our vrittis and samskaras that we can't see past them, we don't really understand the nature and the causes of our suffering until we've made some progress in calming the vrittis and samskaras and vasanas, because otherwise there's just too much noise going on inside us to be able to actually understand what's causing it. So, in other words, it's only when we've achieved some measure of inner quiet that we start to be able to actually see our personal Prakriti, our thoughts and feelings, and to see how much of our notion of reality, our experience of reality, is actually a personal creation based on samskaras and not necessarily a true picture of reality at all. And, you know, if you're like most of us, it's not that hard to see ways in which other people's view of reality doesn't make sense. You know, we can fact check everybody and see that many, many of us are just operating under various forms of delusion. It's harder to see our own. So, you know, I'm going to repeat this. It's only when we've achieved a measure of inner quiet and learned how to turn inside and look past the superficial thoughts and feelings to what's behind them, that it becomes possible to look at our personal Prakriti and see how much of our ideas about reality are a personal creation based on our samskaras and not necessarily a true picture of reality at all. And once we're ready and able to see this, it's not so hard to discern between the seer, the true seer, and the fake seer. The fake seer is the observing part of the ego, that part of ahamkara, the I maker. Ahamkara means the one who creates a sense of I out of the available subtle material. So the observing part of the ego, which includes our critical inner voices and that self-conscious tendency that most of us have to monitor ourselves for mistakes, to compare ourselves as to how we're doing, all that stuff, that's part of the human mechanism for self-torture. The observing ego, while it can do good stuff for us, it can stand aside and notice what's going on within us and, make decisions about certain aspects of our behavior. But essentially, the observing ego in its ordinary, untransformed state is a mechanism for self-torture because it never is satisfied with how we are and what we've done, always feeling that there's something wrong, there's something lacking, there's something imperfect. So the observing ego is a mechanism for self-torture. Pure consciousness, the witness, the true seer, is part of, I'm going to use the word mechanism, though it's actually not a good word. Well, the pure consciousness, the witness, is our freedom. It's our real freedom. So, we catch glimpses of the seer through grace, usually often mediated through a self-inquiry process, like the one where you ask yourself, who am I really? And, of course, many contemporary teachers and many teachers in the tradition of Vedanta, in modern times, the Vedanta approach is sometimes called the direct path, based on the way Ramana Maharshi characterized it. So these teachers want you to realize that you're not the person you thought you were, that your real self is awareness. And their practice emphasizes meditation on the knowing aspect of consciousness, which is another name for the seer. So let's just take a minute and do that practice, just ground ourselves in that practice. Again, sit up tall, let yourself grow. And we're just going to play with self-inquiry for a couple of minutes. Your awareness and your breath are, as we've been noting today, are flowing in and out through the heart. And with awareness in the heart, ask yourself, this is a kind of complicated self-inquiry question, but bear with me. If I don't define myself through thoughts, ideas, memories, emotions, or sensations, who am I? Don't look for a verbal answer. Just ask the question and notice what arises. If I don't define myself, actually, I'm going to ask you the question. So just take it in and notice what arises. If you don't define yourself with thoughts, ideas, memories, emotions, or sensations, who are you? Again, if you don't define yourself through thinking, through concepts, through memories, through emotions or feelings or sensations, who are you? What are you? If you don't define yourself through thinking, through concepts, through memories, through emotions, through feelings or sensations, who are you? many of you, I hope, I infer, had a flash of some kind of presence, some kind of awareness. And very often we have a flash and then thoughts come in. We'll do this over the week. And if you didn't feel like you became aware of anything, that's fine. And the truth is that even when we have a strong immediate experience of realizing the witness, the seer, it usually doesn't last unless you cultivate clarity of mind through meditation, because the backpack of samskaras is very strong and overwhelming. And we need to continually, if this is the path we're doing, if the path of inquiry is the path we're doing, we need to refer to it again and again and again, as we do any practice we're doing. And one of the reasons why we always end up coming back to meditation, at least speaking for myself, is that it's through the yoga of meditation that we actually develop a strong enough sense of the abiding self so that we can bear to look at our imperfections. I want to say that again. It's only when you have a strong enough sense of the abiding self, whether it's the self as the inner witness or the self as the sense of the heart, or the self that arises as you do the practices on the inner body. It's only when you have a sense of the self, of this independent being, not touched by all the ideas you have about yourself and what you think other people think about you. It's only then that you can intervene in your own dysfunctional patterns. I know many people who began to benefit from psychotherapy only after they started meditating and catching glimpses of their own core, their own peaceful self. I know this was true for me. Until I knew the self, I would get derailed by, you know, every failure, every mistake, every stupid idea that came through my mind. I would immediately start criticizing myself. And so it was very hard to admit mistakes or to even work on the parts of myself that I felt could use a little improvement. Once I started really having a sense of the self, of the heart, then it was no big deal to look at the qualities in me that were taking me away from joy, that were taking me away from the self, that were basically taking me away from the more enlightened aspects of the self, because there is a platform that you create through meditation, as many of you know, that is stable. It's the place you stand. It's the place you sit. And, you know, when you can sit there, you know that actually nothing you do can invalidate your beauty, your sweetness, your perfection. So the meditations that we've been doing in the last week, the meditation on the center of consciousness in the head, the pranayama that allows us to cultivate the Ajna Chakra by breathing into the soft palate, the meditations on the lotus of the heart, they all aim to kindle a state of light and contentment that can become the field of our focus. And, you know, as we take rest more and more in that lightness and joy that we kindle through these practices, in which, though we may be practicing to kindle them, are actually already there, that, you know, the mind can begin to rest more and more deeply in itself. And meditation becomes a pleasure, which to my mind is an absolute necessity if we're going to do it regularly. You have to find a way to meditate that you enjoy. Sutra, I believe it's 39, it's 38 to 39. One of the sutras that follows the ones we worked with last week says, you can meditate on whatever gives you satisfaction, though the commentator says that it should be something that the sages have kind of agreed is appropriate. Because enjoying meditation is so important. And I also want to say that the Sanskrit words, Jyotismati and Vishoka, light and joy, are not only core qualities of the purified mind, they also are, you know, Jyotismati can be visualized, and you can actually see it as a light. but it can also be experienced as insight, as pure intelligence or awareness. And that is certainly the way that many of us begin to tune into the enlightened quality of our own mind. That insight, that quality of insight, is called in Sanskrit prajna, spelled P-R-A-J-N-A. It's the word prajna basically means intuitive wisdom, and it's a way of knowing that is present in your consciousness that begins to come online as we kindle the feeling of jyotismati, you know, in one of these practices. And of course, vishoka, joy, is often experienced as a quality of pleasure. And that, you know, you can, once you start to nestle in these qualities, to abide in them, over time, the restlessness that's so much a part of the ordinary uncultivated mind begins to dissolve, and you actually start to experience the truth that there's more pleasure that you can mine when you attend to the inner universe than is actually possible through the external senses. Obviously there are many delicious experiences that we can have through the senses, but as you know, they all come to an end. And the chance of finding a source of pleasure and intuitive intelligence that we can actually rely on over time can only be found by cultivating those inner experiences of light and joy, of jyotismati and vishoka. This restful pleasure within which insight and guidance can arise, however you get there, the technique doesn't matter. What matters is that you begin to be able to rest in this field, which is the field which the mind can rest in and which will then gradually, over time, melt the mind into the self. So we're going to come back to this and to the sutras that follow. But right now, I want to move us into a discussion of the kleshas and look at how the Yoga Sutras define the state that so many of the Indian texts call bondage and the ways it causes suffering. Now that word bondage is like the word love. It has many levels of meaning, and it's such a cliche that we actually have to do a lot of unpacking before we can really feel what bondage is. But here's a definition. We define bondage as the experience of being stuck, limited, unable to see your own vastness and light, unable to actually take rest in yourself, because, you know, even unable to go past a certain point in meditation, because your senses have been, as it were, shut down, limited, like the way when you put a governor in a car so the car can't go beyond a certain speed. What we call bondage is actually a kind of a governor that's put on our capacities so that we can't see what really is. And that you know, that governing experience that the texts call bondage is absolutely real. And it's not your fault. It's not because you did anything wrong. It's not because Adam and Eve tasted the fruit of knowledge in the garden and were banished from their eternal bliss, from their home of bliss. It's simply the way things work. I'll talk about that in a moment. Secondly, we need to understand bondage because, you know, first because it's real. Second, because if we don't pinpoint the root causes of our pain, we're just going to end up putting words on our suffering and imagining that it comes from somewhere else or from our own imperfections or from, you know, other people. And third, because when we really look into the causes of our suffering and realize that nothing external is ever going to permanently fix us, we recognize that yoga is really the only solution. And that, in my experience, is totally necessary if we're really going to practice yoga in a way that can realize the potential that yoga has for us. Another reason I believe that the sages talk so much about bondage, and especially the kleshas, is because we are so bamboozled by the world and by our own thoughts that we can go through lifetimes without ever noticing that the things we think will make us happy don't actually do that. So we need motivation. We need to be motivated. And one of the things that skilled teachers do, and these sages are definitely skilled teachers, is offer us both carrots and sticks. The carrot, of course, is the beauty and the power that we experience when we deeply engage the course in the practices. And the carrot that the sages offer us is their descriptions of the exquisite quality of the self and the inner world and the light of consciousness. The tantric sages are particularly good at doing this. The stick, of course, is the suffering itself and the suffering that we will inevitably experience if we don't take practice seriously. The Buddhists are really good at talking about suffering and how inevitable it is if we don't do practice. And one of the ways that we come into spiritual practice is through the door of recognizing the inevitability of suffering, because most of us have an easier time identifying with our limitations, even when we know that they hurt us, and even when we have been told by so many great masters that they are not really who we are. It's easier for us to identify with our own limitations than to identify with our own light, as in that beautiful sentence of statement of Marianne Williamson that Barry quoted last week in one of her posts. Our biggest problem is not realizing our own greatness. I'm not quoting it right, sorry. But you know what I mean. But what the Yoga Sutras tells us again and again is that our suffering is the result of a misunderstanding and that it can be eliminated. In the Sutras on Karma, in Book 2, there's a sentence, "The pain that is to come can and should be avoided." So, and this is obviously not an overnight process. You can't take a pill and have your delusion disappear the way a strep infection disappears with the right antibiotic. But when you realize the seriousness of the dilemma, and it helps us realize the seriousness of the response that life demands of us, and I do feel that, you all know this, we're in the middle of a giant wake-up call right now, and life is making a big demand on us. And here's another piece which I just find really exquisite and really important. And it's kind of the grace, the recognition that all this happens because of grace. In Tantra, it's said that this entire manifest universe exists for the sake of revealing our real nature to us. That's the purpose of this world, which is a pretty far out idea if you look at how complex this world is. So, the yogic paradigm that this world exists for us goes on to say that the universe has two purposes: to give the soul, who is a form of the divine soul, a limited form of the divine soul, to give the soul experience and to inspire liberation from this view that we're actually limited. So the experiences that you have in embodied life allow your soul to grow, to develop, and ultimately to understand what makes you happy and what gives you pain. And we could, first of all, we couldn't be here. We couldn't do this if we could see through the illusion. It's our very experience of limitation that lets us get involved in the drama of human life. So ignorance is part of the journey, and it's here to teach us about our own possibilities, to help us experience, work through, and disentangle us from our karmic accretions. And in order to experience ourselves as the true enjoyers of the universe, the individual consciousness has to contract, has to suffer, has to search. My guru once said, God loses God, God looks for God, and God finds God. It is God who questions and God who answers. And, you know, this is really hard to understand until we have the realization of what we are. But when consciousness unfolds to the point where we can experience the way things are and the reason why they are this way, we understand that the experience of bondage has to happen in order for us to be willing to learn what we are and ultimately to experience the exquisite beauty of this world that has been made for our enjoyment. So the kleshas are meant to operate as a dharma bell, a wake-up call that show us that we need to look deeper to understand ourselves at a less superficial level. So since suffering is meant to inspire us to look under the surface of events, to realize the assumptions that we're relying on that are basically fucking us up, that means that we need to be willing to undergo the destabilization that very often happens when we first start to see what our samskaras are doing to us. I know that when I first began recognizing the ugly parts of my ego, which pretty much happens at the beginning of anybody's spiritual journey, it sent me into a depression that lasted for months. It was almost unbearable. But because I was having that self-confrontation within the context of spiritual practice, I was able to see it and to use it as fuel for my practice. In other words, to realize that not only was there something I could do about all this, but that my pain was actually gifting me with the motivation for transformation. In fact, one of my friends used to say that the real test of your motivation happens when your practice is advanced enough so that you're not suffering anymore, so that you actually feel pretty good, which for most of us happens fairly early in the journey, even though the suffering is going to come back, you know, as we go through different cycles on the path. But once your samskaras calm down enough so that you start to have a pretty good time in life, it can be tempting to relax and back off, but we always get pushed back onto the path by the discomfort that starts up when you're neglecting deep practice, because the kleshas are gonna kick your butt until they really get dissolved. So understanding the kleshas is a primary part of the journey. And when we get them, we can stop telling ourselves that our suffering is because of something our parents did, or because we're unemployed, or because we don't have enough money or enough friends, or because there's something wrong with us personally. And once you do that, you realize that even your ability to see your own delusion is pointing you towards the reservoir of wisdom that lies behind it. So here we go, Book 2, Sutra 2. And as we start, just let's return to the heart and begin to sense into the field of the heart, inhaling, exhaling, inhaling with hum, exhaling with sa, feeling the wind of the breath, the breeze of the breath, the caress of the breath, opening, softening, bringing you in touch with your own heart. Sutra 2.2, Book 2, Sutra 2, says, the purpose of yoga is to induce samadhi and attenuate the kleshas, the afflictions. And Sutra 2.3 says this, ignorance, false sense of self-identity, attachment, aversion, and fear of death are the afflictions, the kleshas. Ignorance, false sense, which the word, Sanskrit word for ignorance is avidya. We're going to use it a bit tonight. False sense of self-identity, asmita, which is the tendency to identify the self with its tools, the body, the mind, the opinions, etc. Attachment, Sanskrit word is raga. Aversion, Sanskrit word is dvesha. And fear of death, Sanskrit word is abhinivesha, are the kleshas, the afflictions. Ignorance, false identification, attachment, aversion, and fear of death. And the following sutra, Sutra 3, defines these. Non-awareness of what is real, that's ignorance, the sense of egoism, attractions, repulsions, strong desire for life are the kleshas. Avidya, ignorance, is the cause of all the other afflictions, whether they are dormant, attenuated, disjointed, or active. And I just want to say something here about these four conditions of the kleshas. Dormant, attenuated, disjointed, or active. There are two ways that the commentators on this text describe dormant. One way is that, you know, the kleshas are dormant. They say that the kleshas are dormant in a baby. This is actually not true. The kleshas, according to Vyasa and the other kind of most authoritative sages, the kleshas are dormant in somebody who has done their practice to the point where the kleshas become what the tradition calls roasted seeds. You know how they say when a pumpkin seed is roasted, it won't sprout. And that's the state of the dormant kleshas. You can, through practice, roast the seeds of the kleshas so that they don't sprout. This is obviously a very advanced state. And, it's essentially the result of prolonged yoga practice. The second stage of the kleshas, we're going down from the highest, which is the way the Yoga Sutras tend to talk. The second stage of the kleshas is the attenuated state. And the attenuated state is what arises in those of us who are actively engaged in sadhana, who are really meditating and who are actually working on the samskaras. The practice that effectively and immediately works on the kleshas by working on thought forms is called pratipaksha bhavana. Most of you have heard of it or done it, which is essentially the practice of replacing a negative thought or feeling with a positive one. And we are definitely going to be working with that in the future. When the kleshas are attenuated, it's not that they're not there. They're obviously there. But they exist in such an attenuated form that they will often remain inactive even when there's a lot of triggering going on. And in a slightly less advanced state, you can consider your kleshas attenuated when you can catch yourself being triggered and actually work with the klesha in the moment to, kind of not suppress it, but dissolve it. And in my experience, and I know this is true for you, an awful lot of sadhana is about the practice that we do moment to moment to attenuate the kleshas, to work with the kleshas as they arise. When your kleshas are attenuated, you can see them pretty clearly. And you also know that you can't really let them get out of control, get out of hand. One of my students, who's a young woman, currently without a partner, was working this winter with working very closely with a guy who was breaking up with his wife. They became very close. You know this story, of course. It's not an unusual story. And she was kind of half in love with him. He was kind of half in love with her. And the temptation to actually get physically involved with him was almost overwhelming. And because she's a practiced yogini, she started asking herself this question, okay, if I get involved with this guy, what is going to be the result for us? Is this going to end up making me happy, or is it going to cause me suffering? And as she asked that question, she realized that it was going to cause her suffering. And she was able to put a stop to the very strong impulse to get involved with this guy. She had to do it over and over again because the situation was quite active and alive. And the kleshas and the samskaras that came up around it were sort of whispering to her, well, what's the problem? But what she was actually doing was a form of pratipaksha bhavana. She was reminding herself of what the results would be of her getting involved in this relationship. And this is how a yogi with somewhat attenuated samskaras is able to attenuate them further by effective action in the moment. And by the way, the operative thing here, when we talk about the way in which the kleshas impel us to action, the operative thing here is not about conventional religious morality. It's about thoughts and behaviors that create further suffering and take us farther away from enlightenment. So, a yogi in the Patanjali tradition would be looking at their own actions from that point of view all the time. And the third form that the kleshas take is called disjointed, meaning that sometimes they're dormant, and then when there's a big trigger, they come out. And this is the state of a yogi who, in the moment, is able to temporarily kind of damp down the afflictions. You know, for instance, when you're sitting in meditation, when you're on the mat, when you're doing a yoga practice, when you're in satsang, you're able to look at the stuff that comes up and look at it, recognize it, let it go. There's an interesting way of describing this in some of the commentaries. They say that when your samskaras are somewhat attenuated, then, if you're feeling a lot of love, the samskaras of anger or jealousy are dissolved, but they can come up in an instant. They're called, that state kleshas is called disjointed. And finally, for most people, the kleshas are fully active. They're just in full display, and oh my God, we're seeing so much of that around these days. It's when your kleshas are fully active, you just lose it every time something goes wrong. And this is a state of full-on suffering. So these are the four states of the kleshas, the afflictions. And the next sutra defines and describes avidya, primal ignorance. Avidya is not ignorance about the mundane world, but ignorance about who we really are and what is our place in the universe. And yet, in my experience, primal avidya leads to all kinds of forms of ignorance, this, which I'm going to ask you this week to look at. Every piece of cluelessness, misperception, skewed priorities, feelings of limitation, they all come from fundamental ignorance. And at the core of it is, as we said, misperception about who we are, what is real, and what is lasting. So because of avidya, we believe that we're the body, the mind, the personal history, and there's so many levels on which we experience it. One of my friends, I don't know, all of these examples tonight seem to be about relationships, but so it is. So one of my friends, a couple of years ago, had a difficult divorce. His wife fell in love with another man, and he was utterly devastated, and he remained in that devastated state for a couple of years. In that state, he was questioning his own worth, the value of his life choices, indeed, the value of his life. And at one point, he said the reason that it was so destabilizing to him was because he had believed that this relationship would last forever. That is to say, throughout his life, that they would be together till death parted them. And when it ended, he didn't just have to go through the pain of the relationship ending. It actually shifted the ground of his sense of reality. So this is what avidya does. It makes you believe that your sense of worth and identity are tied to your work, tied to your relationship, tied to your family, to your beauty, to your strength, to your skills, to your social position, to your family, to your money. And these are pillars that can dissolve in a moment. And I don't have to say this, but the pandemic, of course, is doing this on a mammoth scale. It's taking away things that we took for granted, and often taking away many things that we didn't take for granted, that we were hanging on to by our fingernails in this society. And in California, in addition to the effects of the virus and its economic impact, we're a couple of months away from wildfire season, at which point it's probable that areas in the state will burn and the air quality in the state will suffer for quite a while. So if our sense of who we are is dependent on things that can be taken away by an illness or a fire, we're in the fully fledged state of avidya. The sutras gives four clues for identifying what avidya is, and they each point to a particular way in which we take surface perceptions for reality. So the sutra says, avidya is to mistake what is perishable for what is eternal, what is impure for what is pure, what is painful for happiness, and the non-self for the true self. This sutra actually can lead you to a deep reflection on the illusory nature of perception. Its primary purpose is to call into question our ideas of who we are, but it's a window into pretty much every form of cluelessness. You know, for instance, mistaking the perishable for the imperishable, it's that denialism that keeps many, many people from believing that the stock market will go on rising, or that we can build houses in wild areas like the place where I live that are prone to fire and flood, or that your romantic relationship is going to last for your lifetime. Of course, on the deeper level, it's what keeps you from seeing that your conception of me, my personality, myself, is not stable and is not permanent. It's just that just as your body is an ever-shifting configuration of atoms and molecules, constantly changing, your internal sense of self basically consists of thoughts and feelings about who you are, like I'm pretty or I'm confused. You know, feelings like happiness or restlessness, moods like depression or hopefulness, all of which are subject to change, all of which are changing all the time. Okay, big breath in. Let's return to the heart. Inhaling and exhaling with Hamsa, reminding us of who we really are. Tuning into the heart. So the heart, at its core, is pure. Arising in this pure space of the heart are many, many thoughts, feelings, ideas, many, many passing states. And some of these passing states, thoughts and emotions and body sensations, are very pleasurable, some of them not so pleasurable. But when you are mistaking what is actually impure for what is pure. That's the state in which you feel love in your heart, which is, you know, love at its core is a very pure feeling. But somehow that love is filled with conditions. And, you know, one example that I think is pretty widespread is, you know, the way we feel about a young child, a baby. You know, you can adore your baby, your child, and look at that child sleeping or, you know, sitting on your lap and laughing, and the love you feel is so wide and pure. And then the child just starts acting like a brat, or, you know, as I know is happening for many people, is home during the lockdown, the social distancing, and going crazy with boredom and just making you crazy. And you realize that, you know, in those moments, you do not actually experience active love for your child. Some of us are capable of holding on to that love even when the kid is driving us crazy. But most of us realize in those moments that our love is not pure, it's conditional. And therefore, to base our relationship or our feelings about our work on the idea that we are purely settled in our affection and commitment is actually to mistake what is conditional for what is unconditioned. In other words, what is impure for what is pure. So believing that pain is joy, believing that pain is joy, such a basic yogic idea, you know, that misperception that pain is joy has been kicking your butt ever since the time you longed for a toy, believing that having it would be the best thing ever, that it would make you happy, and then broke it or just got bored with it and realized that in the pain, and boredom is a form of pain, the toy didn't make you happy. There's a story that an old friend of mine who's a teacher of yoga and spirituality used to tell years ago, and some of you in this group have studied with her, so you may be familiar with this story. And it's about how her son was about 6 and had to stay home from first grade one day because he was sick, and she was looking for a way to, you know, kind of engage him, and she was doing laundry. She said, let's go sit on the washing machine. I'm not quite sure why she said it, but they got up, sat on the washing machine, which was, you know, working and vibrating, and they got into a conversation, and they had just a terrific time, just sitting on the washing machine, hanging out. And then the moment was over, and they went back to the rest of their day. Later on that afternoon, her son said to her, Mom, can we go sit on the washing machine again? You know, that, and so they did, but it just didn't feel the same, you know, that because the happiness that they had felt in that moment was not about the washing machine. It was about something that had gone on between them in that moment. And, of course, this is something that is one of the big disappointments of life, that moment when something that made us happy doesn't make us happy anymore, whether it's the fifth bite of mango sherbet or the walk in the park with your beloved, which you had such a great time with yesterday but are not having such a great time with today, or almost everything that we do that gives us pleasure and makes us happy comes to an end, gives us disappointment, or simply loses its charge for us. So mistaking the false self for the true self, which is the gist of it, the essence of it, is that tendency that makes us identify with our ideas and thoughts and moods without recognizing that within them is the you that is unchanging, joyful, and fully aware. And this is how my friend who divorced his wife became so identified with his pain at that loss that he could not recognize himself, because he believed that his true self was the person who was married to his wife. And when that ended, he was plunged into a quality of suffering that every one of us has experienced. So behind all of Avidya's manifestations is the failure to recognize that you're spirit and that you share that with every atom of existence. The four other aspects of the kleshas, the four other kleshas, are asmita, the tendency to identify the self with the instruments of experience, which we just spoke about, and to construct an identity based on our memories of former experience, the pleasure and pain, the accumulated memories that we identify as our history and that we ultimately identify as us. And you know, in those moments when you are completely merged in the present moment, however that happened, you know, whether it happened in meditation or during a run or, you know, one of those moments when the sun, you look at the sunset and you're just expanded. In those moments of being fully in presence in the present, there actually is no identification with anything other than that open consciousness. But inevitably, invariably, something comes up and says, oh, I'm having an experience, and then there you are in asmita. And at this moment, there is automatically the birth of attachment. Let's go sit on the washing machine. That was a good experience. I want to keep it. You know, I want to have the meditation experience that I had in my Vipassana retreat because it was so great. Can I recreate it? You know, can we feel as good as we felt that time when we were making love in the moonlight 2 years ago? That was so good. And of course, attachment has so many layers and so many pieces to it. We could go on for the next 2 weeks about our experiences of attachment and also our experiences of aversion, because, you know, the point is that when we believe we're this body-mind, then we are drawn to what gives it pleasure and we push away what gives it pain. And of course, the thing that gives the most pain is loss, especially the loss of the body. So attachment and aversion make us fear loss, especially make us fear death. And that fear of death, that fear of loss, very much gets in our way in spiritual practice. Because if you've ever had a sudden opening in meditation, you may have experienced the fear that can accompany it. The fear that, the feeling that if your consciousness expands that much, you could die. Fear of death is often described as the ego's fear of dissolution, the ego's fear of losing its boundaries. And, you know, I know that many people write to me or share with me that they've had a huge opening and now they're afraid to sit for meditation because they're afraid that they're going to get lost in it. My guru used to often say to students when he was leading us in meditation, he would say, don't worry, if you get lost, I'll find you. And I always loved that. It's actually quite important for us to feel that we have a refuge, that we're not going to get lost in meditation because there is something there within the universe which is going to take care of us, which is going to find us. And in my experience, it's in the heart that we begin to actually take rest, in the sense that there actually is no such thing as death. Again, let's bring yourselves back into the heart. Inhaling with hum, exhaling with sa. Feeling the breath caressing the space behind the breastbone. Having having the feeling that within your heart, within this presence, in the very center of your body, the heart lotus, your true self has a seat. Your soul has a seat. And that seated along with the self in the heart is that presence, that divine presence, which we can call the inner guru, the inner divinity, the inner light, which the Yoga Sutra calls Ishvara. That presence, which even if you don't feel it at this moment, is nonetheless there, which is meditating on you, which, if you get lost, will find you, and which, when you die, when you leave this body, will accompany you to the next adventure and protect you along the way. So just let yourself meditate on the heart with hum and sa, with even the provisional awareness that within your heart is everything that you long for. Everything that you most deeply suspect you are. That part in you which is free, which is in love, and which is both utterly independent and utterly in relationship to the Beloved. One way we see the kleshas in action is that habit we have of thinking that you need someone else's approval to feel good about yourself. I mean, you might know this isn't true, that making your self-esteem contingent on the way other people feel about you is a bit like trying to buy zucchini at the Gap. But knowing that doesn't really change your feelings until you start looking into them, until you start looking past what the mind habitually tells you and questioning its conclusions about reality, and then go a step further and start to notice how feelings create thoughts and thoughts create feelings and how the reality they construct for you is actually a construct. So that's when you can get to see that you can turn a mood around by changing the way you think about it. So I'm going to take you through a process that I'm going to suggest that you work with yourself this week, and I'm going to use myself as an example. One of the great moments for catching your own kleshas in operation, especially the fundamental avidya, is to tune into the first moments after you wake up in the morning. I started this practice about 10 years ago. One morning, I was living on the coast in Carmel, California, and in June and July in Carmel, it's very, very gray. So I would wake up in the morning, and this particular morning, I woke up, and I looked out at the gray sky outside my window, and I immediately started feeling lonely and slightly sad. So this is not my usual experience. So it caught my attention, and I started asking what it was about, you know, and so I tuned into the feeling, and I realized there was this dull sort of sinking energy in my body, and I noticed that as I experienced that feeling, almost simultaneously with the feeling, something would grab hold of it and identify with it. So it wasn't that there was sadness, it was that I was sad. And the inner experience, once I had felt the sadness and started to identify with it, was of this pervasive kind of grayness, not just outside but also within me. And of course, this is what ahamkara actually does. It constructs a sense of me out of these separate components of inner experience. So the inner dialogue went something like this. Oh no, another gray day. I can't stand it. I just can't stand it. Maybe I should move. No, it's not the weather. It's me. It's, you know, my family genes. There's this tendency to sadness. And, you know, within minutes, I had just written off my entire day. So because the thought stream is so pervasive and the habit of identifying with it is so ingrained, you actually need to make an effort to recognize what's going on. But what you start to see as you pay attention is that these mechanisms of identification and self-definition are running on autopilot. I mean, they're like the crawl on CNN. The mood, the thought, even the feeling of me is a loop. It's maybe a repetitive loop, so repetitive that, you know, it feels like the truth. But if you look at it closely, you see that like the crawl, it's passing through. So, and the problem, the avidya, is entirely about identifying with it. So if you're able to think, okay, here comes sadness, rather than I'm sad, or, oh, here comes a brilliant idea, rather than I'm so brilliant, you have temporarily stepped outside of avidya, out of that tendency to mistake the not-self for the self and to mistake the impermanent for the eternal. True, those feelings may have deep roots. They're rooted in the kleshas because, after all, you've been identifying yourself as this or that for years. But actually, if you really look at it, you realize that letting that sad feeling define you is actually as dumb as for an actor playing Julius Caesar to come off the stage and start giving commands to the stagehands, you know, as if they were his soldiers. So that morning, I remembered to work with the feeling. I closed my eyes again, and I breathed into the belly, and I filled up my lungs because, you know, it's such a great practice, sort of ujjayi pranayama, letting the prana wash away the kind of detritus of the night, and feeling the sensuality of the breath. And I watched the feelings with focus on the breath. And I reminded myself that I'm not my thoughts, which, believe me, even though I'm a sort of advanced practitioner, is not easy when you're caught in a mood like that. And I noticed what actually was going on, that this mood of sadness was acting like a pair of blue-colored glasses, literally coloring everything. And in that state, stuff that is absolutely normal, like, you know, a friend not calling you back, begins to look like the end of the world, you know, total rejection. Even the landscape can start to look sad. So, and then in that moment, on that day, the sun came out. And I noticed that the moment the sun came out, my gray mood dissipated. And at that moment, the self-identification mechanism was saying, oh, I'm happy. See, that was just a reaction to the weather. Actually, I'm fine. I'm a joyful person. My practice worked. And in fact, the mind was engaging in the very same process, grabbing the mood, identifying it, this time describing it as happy, then identifying myself as happy. In that moment, I realized that to free yourself from false identification, from avidya and asmita, means being willing to free yourself from identifying with the happy mood. And what you notice here is that along with that identification, and we're just talking here about inner thoughts and feelings, not even about, you know, the other stuff, the external stuff, it leads immediately to feelings of aversion. Oh, my God, I'm depressed. I can't stand it. I've got to get out of this. Or attachment. Ah, I feel so good. Let me go out in the sun and cultivate that feeling. And these bring up fear, fear that the sadness might be a sign that, you know, you're actually going into a depression or that, you know, where you're living is problematic. The process of attenuating the kleshas starts with noticing, you know, you kind of can work backwards with it. You can start with noticing the fear and where it sits in your body, allowing your aversion to the fear or the depression or the anger to simply be there, allowing your attachment to the good state to simply be there, and then to look at the tendency to identify with happiness, sadness, or fear, allow it to be there. And then to work directly with the avidya by re-identifying yourself with the witnessing self or with the experience of the heart. And in this way, the inquiry of being willing to look into your thoughts, stand beside them, drop them. You know, really drop them and reorient your identification such that you're practicing to know yourself at a higher level. Those two things, the meditation on the self or something that leads you to the self, and the willingness to inquire into the kleshas, the samskaras, the vrittis, rather than taking them so seriously that you believe them and identify with them. That is fundamentally the yogic sadhana of Raja Yoga. There's more to it than that, but essentially that's it. We unpick the kleshas, we attenuate the kleshas by constantly being willing to see through them and replace them or dissolve them or drop them and reorient ourselves to remembrance of what we are. In Sutra 40 of Book 1, it says, a mind free from its roaming tendencies is like a crystal. It takes the form of whatever object is in its proximity. So in other words, our thoughts and feelings, our moods are the filter that, you know, that covers the mind so we can only see reality, whether inner reality or external reality, through that filter. Once we clear off the vrittis, once we clear off the samskaras that are coming up at a given moment, and especially once we have managed to attenuate the kleshas so that such that they don't grab us, you know, anytime they come up, then what starts to happen is that the mind becomes a clear and crystalline tool, as it were, though it's much more than a tool. And we start to notice that the creative consciousness of the mind, the citta, which, remember, has the nature of citti, of the supreme creative consciousness, that the mind is utterly transparent to whatever is being put into it, to whatever it is seeing. So, for instance, at this moment, I'm in my office and I'm looking out my window at the trees and the hills behind the trees, and this is quite a peaceful scene. So to some large extent, my mind is colored by the nature I'm watching. One reason why looking at nature is so soothing. You may be in a different setting, but as your mind becomes clear, it becomes an utterly clear instrument, like a crystal, which reflects whatever is put in front of it without distorting it by the samskaras and vrittis. And it's at that point that you actually begin to have some real capacity to discern truth from untruth. When we give ourselves an object of focus deliberately and consciously, the object of focus we give ourselves should be one which allows the mind to reflect something beautiful, something that turns us towards the self. As you know, if you spend 2 hours watching the news, you're going to look up from the screen and find that your mental and emotional state has been fully colored by what you saw there. If you focus your mind on a beautiful flower, you'll experience your mind relaxing and opening. And if you place in front of your mind an image that draws you towards truth, that draws you towards an enlightened state, then that which you've given your attention to will all by itself begin to dissolve vrittis and open you inward. We're going to do a practice that potentially speaks about in Sutra 38 in Book 1. That sutra says, this section of Book 1 that we were studying last week is about the practices that we do for calming the mind and eliminating the obstacles to samadhi. They're actually a collection of practices that tend to make us open to samadhi, that make the mind available to samadhi. So this sutra, it's actually Sutra Book 137. The ability to retain the peaceful flow of mind comes by someone whose perception is not colored by desire and ego. The ability to retain the peaceful flow of mind comes by focusing on someone who is free, whose perception is not colored by desire and ego. The way this practice is normally done is by choosing the image of a great sage like Buddha or Ramakrishna or Christ, and you'll immediately recognize that these are well-known practices, especially in devotional tradition, or of a deity, which is a practice that we ourselves often do, and allowing that image to shed its coloration into your mind so that your mind becomes filled with this very pure image of a form of a human or humanoid form that carries the qualities of awake consciousness, of love, of truth, of clarity. And by immersing yourself in that, you actually begin to take those qualities into yourself. I want to do a version of this in which we create a form of ourselves as an enlightened being, a form of ourselves as having the qualities of deity. So close your eyes, find your posture, and you can find that place in the heart that we've been entering into and breathing through. And let the breath just open your heart to itself. Now from that place of connection to your own heart, imagine yourself seated by the lake, or if you prefer, seated in a garden, a natural place where the atmosphere is very pure, very beautiful. And if at this moment you say, where do I find myself? That place will appear. It doesn't even have to be a place that seems physical. So feel yourself sitting in it. Place which is utterly safe, utterly sacred, utterly beautiful. A place that represents what we might call the cave of the heart. And you see seated before you your own form. You look the way you look now. You're the age you are right now. This may not be exactly the form you see when you look in the mirror, but it's very recognizably you. However, it's the enlightened you, the fully awake you, the you whose every pore is filled with love, with wisdom, and with the confidence that comes from knowing that you are the embodiment of truth. Without doubt, just go for it. Feel the presence of this enlightened self, who we could say is your future self, or maybe your present self. Why not? You are already that. Sitting in front of you, and just allow yourself to be present with that being, with that enlightened version of yourself. Your focus is in the heart. And as you gaze at this being who is yourself, seated in front of you. Just notice what you see. Is there a sense of light within this being? Does this enlightened self appear with colors? What is the feeling that you have as you look at yourself in this form? If in the process, this connection to the enlightened self morphs or changes or becomes the form of a deity or a sage or someone else, that's okay. What really matters is the felt sense of connection to the enlightened human being, the awake, love-immersed, love-saturated beauty of an awakened being, the awakened you. And as you breathe in, feel that the self being in front of you is sending rays of love and light from their heart into yours. So that with every inhalation, you draw in the felt sense of the enlightened being that is yourself. And with every exhalation, you breathe out feelings of acceptance, gratitude, a successive experience of opening. And you might find the mantra Hamsa arising with the breath. Or you might feel words coming from the enlightened self in front of you, flowing towards you, or of words flowing from you to them. And as thoughts arise, when you notice the thought, just let it go and allow yourself to sit with the being of light, the enlightened you, and allow their coloration, their flavor, their fragrance to permeate you. As we draw this session to a close, I'd like to suggest that you take a moment or two and journal about this last meditation or anything that occurred that you would like to record or any insights that arose. The audio for tonight will be sent to you in the morning, and the homework assignment will come tomorrow. You'll also, of course, be receiving the study guide for this week. And on Sunday at noon Pacific time, we're going to have a Q&A, which hopefully is at a time when certainly some of the Europeans can be present, and maybe others. Thank you so much for being here and for what you create as we sit together. Namaste. So much love to all of you.
Asato ma satgamaya tamaso.